Welcome inside to yet another edition of Robin Pod. I spent the weekend largely stuck in constantly reminding myself that it was Civil War and Apple Cup weekend. Many of you that listen know where HQ is based. So Apple Cup and Civil War being on a different weekend, it's a pretty big deal, pretty big shift. And what timing with the reorganization of the Pac-12 for those games to occur. We're going to talk about that with Eben coming up in about 7 minutes after we run through next week's card really quick. A little bit shorter pod this week. No podcast next week, by the way, for those of you keeping score. I'm sure none of you are. But we will be back the following with Jake Feldman from Sportico. A little bit different twist. For those of you that are just sick and tired of Eben always being so right, Jacob will offer perhaps a different perspective, although he too is often right. It was a bad slate of games that ended up being kind of interesting. Not a bad weekend per se from a viewing perspective. From the perspective of the tournament, major shout out to the Ranger of the North, Alex Aragon. He hung in all weekend, defending season-long champion Chelsea Goss, tried to run it back. She had another insanely hot streak. She got, I believe, 10 out of 12 picks correct, if I'm not mistaken. She missed the first week, so she's going to be bumped down a little bit in the season standings. But nonetheless, she's had a great showing starting late in week two. Alex hung in there and hung in there, and he had Kentucky to win or to lose by fewer than 18 points, i.e. just to keep it decent. And Kentucky kept it more than decent, providing actually quite a bit of drama late Saturday night. They did not hang on to beat the number one team in the country, but they kept it very tight and they dictated the pace of the game. Georgia made some mistakes. It was an ugly slog fest, which is exactly what Kentucky wanted to make it. So Alex won that pick. He got 177 points based on that prediction. Chelsea's late night prediction, I believe, was TCU to win or to lose by fewer than three against UCF. That hit, but it only hit to the tune of 100 points. Alex's 177 vaulted him over her winning 100, and he ended up squeaking out a victory by, I want to say, something like 26 points. So shout out to Alex. Chelsea in second. Uptown, Carter Brown. He's Uptown because he's like Carter Puderschmidt from Family Guy. That's why he's Uptown. Uptown Carter Brown in third place. So congratulations to all involved there. It was great action. Higher point totals this week than in weeks past. So I'm not sure if that's an omen of things to come. Maybe we need to make the plus points selections a little bit more difficult. We're not going to do a big review of last week. We're going to get right into the card. So if imaginary producer Steve could please round the tape. We have yet another 12 games on the card for the Week 4 tournament presented by RotoWire. It is RotoWire's final week of sponsorship with us, giving out those free season-long subscriptions. Thank you very much to them. We'll get right into it. At noon Eastern on ABC, North Carolina State at Clemson. The slate ain't that good this week either, folks, and that is why we were left with no choice but to put on the middling top 40 matchup of NC State Clemson. You know how we have felt earlier this season about North Carolina State. Clemson is obviously in a bit of flux, trying to regain themselves, go on a deeper run. ACC is wide open, although I think Cal is probably the favorite, right? G5 game of the week, noon Eastern, ACC on G5 game of the week, noon Eastern on ACC Network, James Madison at North Carolina. Continue to be really impressed by the style of play of James Madison. I don't think they're quite as good this year, but they're still going to be really tough. North Carolina, they're going to do what they do. Give it to Omarion. Max Johnson is gone, obviously. Should be interesting. JMU stacking the box. Defense is what they are known for. 3:30 p.m. Eastern on CBS, USC at Michigan. USC played really well against LSU. We all saw what the defense did, how it was changed. I think their defense will look pretty good against Michigan. Michigan's on the back foot now. They had Texas at home. We saw how that went. This could be a very similar script. These are two powerhouse brands, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm giving the Trojans the benefit of the doubt against what I thought was a stout defense, and then Quinn Ewers told me otherwise. 3:30 p.m. Eastern, ESPN2, Georgia Tech at Louisville. It is one of several games in this sort of middle of the afternoon, East Coast time, lunchtime, West Coast time slate or window. It's the first look for us of the season at Louisville, which every year begs us to take it seriously. And unless Lamar Jackson is playing, we kind of don't. That is my cynical ACC viewpoint. I really was rooting for Georgia Tech to kind of keep the momentum rolling after Florida State and then just didn't get it done versus Syracuse. We'll see. It still should be a pretty good game. 4 p.m. Eastern on Fox. I was so hyped on this matchup. Utah at Oklahoma State. I was so hyped on this matchup early season. I had this one circled on the calendar back in August, but Oklahoma State is not as bulletproof on defense as perhaps I wished for. Maybe that wasn't logic talking. Maybe it was what I wished for. And again, as of this recording, we don't know yet because we are recording this really early. We don't know about Cam Rising's availability. But obviously a very different team Utah is without him. The Utah State game this past week, the Baylor game the week before, Utah just kind of getting by. And that will work until you get to a certain point. This still may be the class of the Big 12. Kansas State will have something to say about that. But it doesn't seem to have the same luster as it did in the preseason. Should still be a great game, though. 4 p.m. Eastern, ABC, Miami at South Florida. 4 p.m. Eastern, ABC, Miami at South Florida. The reason this is on here is because Miami is going on the road, and South Florida does weird things sometimes to big-name opponents. And this fits this bill. Cam Ward is going for a Heisman. Miami is going to run the table in the ACC? I don't know. I couldn't have really said that with a straight face just now. I was joking earlier when I said Cal was the favorite in the ACC. Does Miami play Cal? They do. Miami does play Cal on October 5th. That's going to be I'm hyped for that matchup. That's weird and delicious that those could be two of the best teams in the ACC this year. I could not tell you something intelligent about South Florida, so I'm not going to try, but this game is on the card. 3:40 p.m. Eastern on ABC. Oh, this is out of order. 3:40 p.m. Eastern on ABC, 20 minutes prior to that kickoff, UCLA at LSU. I hate that we included this. The reason I hate that we included this is because we've had LSU, I feel like, every single week. We like to offer different teams on different weeks, not ignore teams for a whole year and not put them on the card every single week. The other reason I hate this is because UCLA has really underwhelmed, and so this is just a brand game. These are two big brands. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a great game. I believe LSU is a 3-touchdown favorite at least. That will only go up. UCLA looked awful against Indiana. 5 p.m. Eastern on the CW. TCU at SMU. All I'm going to say about this, we got the TCU Horny Toad logo in the card, second straight week. Looks dastardly. And we got that smooth 80s Mustangs logo on the other side. Just check it out for the card. It's a Texas shootout. Who doesn't love that? 7 p.m. Eastern on ESPN2, Cal at Florida State. I might be coming on here a little too strong with the Cal love. I don't think I've ever loved anything about Cal, ever. But Wilcox, Jay Knott, what they did to Auburn, I thought it was cool. I think their move to the ACC is beyond idiotic. We're going to talk a lot about Cal and Stanford with Eben momentarily. This is on here because this is purely just to see how bad can it get for FSU. Can they really go 0-4? And the answer is they can. And the fact that Cal, of all people, in their first ever ACC football in-conference game could be the one to do it, that's just, it's too delicious to ignore. And I'm not anti-Florida State. I don't really have any opinion on any Florida schools. 7:30 p.m. Eastern on NBC, Iowa at Minnesota. I hope you have alcohol. Good luck on this one. I don't know to think if Iowa has an offense or they don't. I don't know if one should think of this Iowa team as they thought of all Iowa teams in the past. I do know that we're still in the season of football, i.e. September, when we can kind of take Minnesota seriously. We have the Minnesota Goldie Gopher logo in the card. So that's kind of the highlight of this one for me. Also, Iowa, Minnesota, primetime, NBC, the TV pairings continue to be nonsensical. The second best game of the week, the best for some, 7:30 p.m. Eastern on ABC. It is Tennessee at Oklahoma. Heupel coming home. We almost did a game preview on this one in the offseason. Listen, I think Oklahoma has been hot and cold. They've been stop and start. I thought the Tulane game was going to be a get-right game. It kind of was. It kind of was after they limped past Houston. Tennessee's just been on fire. So to me, this is going to be an awesome opportunity to see how does Oklahoma's defense respond to Tennessee's offense and who wins that battle. So I'm excited for this one. Last but not least, we did have to have a late-night chaos matchup. And we did have to have it with one of the teams that this contest is known for. It's their debut on the card. Actually, two of the teams that this contest is known for very different reasons. Kansas State at BYU, 10:30 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Really looking forward to this. Kansas State availed themselves really well. This is another road test. BYU has actually started the season undefeated. Kansas State obviously going to be favored here. This is another critical step on their way towards a very strong Big 12 record, if not a first place Big 12 record. That is the card for week four. We're going to do a quick word about our sponsors, and we're going to bring in Eben, who's sitting in the corner, as he always does, waiting patiently to talk all things house settlement, NIL, Pac-12 realignment, a very interesting Michigan lawsuit, and why is the FBI investigating the George Washington revolutionaries? Back in a sec. This fall, Robin is partnering with several awesome partners to help put on our college football prediction tournaments, and we got to shout out a few of them right now. First, Club Sportico. They're obviously a presenting sponsor of the tournaments, and they are a newsletter and a community from the reporters at Sportico aimed at breaking down the billions of dollars flowing into and changing sports. They're offering tournament prizes and giveaways as well. And they're going to help the commissioner, that's me and friends, make sense of the dominant stories across the sports business landscape each week on this podcast. Check them out at clubsportico.substack.com. Teams That Matter is a Friday morning newsletter from longtime Robiners, Sam, the Ransom Note, Ransom, and Michael, the Pelequin Brief, Pelequin. It's offering their takes on all things college football and other titillating topics. TTM is going to help you get your head in the game as we move into each of these precious college football Saturdays, and they hope that they're going to do it with a little bit more nuance, a little bit more tact, a little bit more mindfulness than maybe the ESPNification of everything these days. Check them out at theteamsthatmatter.com. And last but not least, Volume Pigs. Hilarious name, but actually a seriously good site. He's an economist by day, but he's a college fantasy football writer by night. He's a first-year Robiner. His name is Justin VP Leo, and he started the newsletter just 1 year ago. It's already a bestseller over on Substack. I can attest there's something at Volume Pigs for any college football fan, even if you don't play fantasy, because I don't, and I read it and love it. Check it out over at volumepigs.com. We have a five pack again. That was suitable last time. It's not on brand, but it doesn't matter. When you're Eben the savant Novi Williams predicting what's going to happen with the Pac-12 raiding the Mountain West from the inside out, you don't have to stick to script. So, you know, five pack, six pack, it doesn't matter. Let's talk about the rise of the Pac-12, or as I call them, the Frankenstein 12.
The Pac-6?
Pac-8? Yeah, Pac-6.
We call them this thing.
I have infinite questions. I'll only get to a few of them here on topic number one. What is the Mountain West going to do with $111 million? A tenth of $1 billion.
My guess is they're going to try to do exactly what the Pac-12 did, right? Like raid the next best available group of things to try to reconstitute something that looks like a conference. I mean, it feels, all this stuff, Will, feels like to me it is just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, right?
Sure, like, because I you was keep actually, doing this, you keep doing this and you keep going down and like you raid the WAC and then the WAC raids the Big West and then eventually you're something to raid.
Conference USA refills the American and the Sun Belt refills Conference USA. Yeah, it just feels like it's just all rearranging things.
I think that, but there's two separate things though. Some of it is just pointlessly rearranging, but the other aspect of it is just rearranging things or stealing things that are decreasing in value the more you go down. And so, yeah, the Mountain West can raid the next lowest conference, but then what do you have to sell eventually, nothing, right?
What does the Pac-12 have to sell? To be totally honest, I mean, I get that it's better than the Mountain West now, but yeah, I was actually kind of surprised at all of the kind of the gushy coverage of this news this week about how back the Pac-12 is and all that. I mean, I was laughing in the office today. It feels to me like, I don't know if you've ever had a friend say like, oh, I'm seeing a concert tonight. I'm seeing the Allman Brothers. And you're like, wait a second, Greg Allman's dead. Dwayne Allman's dead. Dickie Betts is dead. You're not seeing the Allman Brothers. You're seeing a group playing Allman Brothers songs. Right, it's just like that to me. It is the Pac-12 just rebranded the Mountain West this week. That's what happened,
more or less.
That's essentially what this is.
I still think they could be back. I think saying they're back in this iteration is not accurate, but this could lead them to take steps to form some sort of West Coast quasi super conference, even though it's not at the level of a true super conference. I think if they keep going, and time is not on their side, right? They've got to do the TV negotiations for the 2026 season. Those always happen well in advance. This gets to my next question, actually. How many teams, obviously they need 8 for the auto bid. A lot of this, I think that more of this is about the TV deals than it is about automatic, you know, CFP berths. I could be wrong, but how many teams and what teams do you think they need to get a more covetous TV deal? And with who do you think that's going to go to? Please tell me it's going to be the CW, because I need San Jose State Wazoo on the CW at 9 p.m. local.
If you look at the map and where everybody is, your dream two are Clemson and Florida State. I think that is very, very unlikely, but that's your dream scenario. Yeah. If you want the Pac-12 to be back in any, even a sliver of what it was, those are your top two candidates. I think it's highly unlikely. It also seems unlikely they would take anyone else from the Mountain West, because if they were going to, it seems like they would have just done it all in one grouping. I'm sure there's some teams in Conference USA or in the American that are interesting to them. It does feel like even for a conference of this tier, geography be damned, I think they're going to be willing to talk to whoever. Gonzaga is an interesting one, obviously up where you are, in terms of not a football school, obviously, but a school that others have looked at and could bring value in some capacity, primarily in basketball. And on the media side, who knows? I think they're going to do one of these things that is the modern league media deals. That's like, it's everybody. You give Thursday night game to ION and a Friday night game to the CW, and you let Amazon take an exclusive window on Saturday mornings and just patchwork your way through it. They have a kind of an advantage in that there's not much in the market right now for college sports. So unlike the last time they were in the market, when the Big 12 was also in the market and jumped ahead of them, they have a little bit of a window here to play with in terms of being creative, not feeling like someone's breathing down their neck. I do think they should move quickly. But going back to what I said at the beginning, I just don't understand where the market value is for a conference that is essentially the top half or the middle of the Mountain West plus the dregs of the old Pac-12. It just doesn't seem like they've changed much of anything at all.
Agree now. I don't think anyone believes that they're done, or that this is like, I mean, this, they can't be done. If this is it, then it's not, they're not even to the 8 team.
So if we take Clemson and Florida State off the board, and I think we take Cal and Stanford off the board as well, who moves the needle here in your mind that is a realistic football school?
It depends on what you value. Do you value TV market? If you value TV market, I think there's a lot of ways to go.
Let's say they value TV money, which is what I think they. We talked about this last week. I'm not convinced that market matters. I think money matters, and that is national brand, fan base size, who's watching the games.
Sure. If it's truly about if it's about a national brand and a national fan base, there's no one on the list. There's no list.
I agree with that.
There's no list. Totally so if that is your rubric, if that is the metric by which you're measuring success, then have fun being one of the group of six conferences. I think they have to be working at least on the assumption that there is more to it that can get an a la carte three or four different headed monster of TV rights partners excited beyond a national brand, because there are no national brands, right?
Yeah.
I disagree that they're done raiding the Mountain West, because if you're a school in the Mountain West, you knew this was going to happen. There's no reason why you wouldn't want to get on the boat. And quite frankly, I go back to UNLV. Las Vegas is a top 35 TV market. UNLV is a storied brand as much as anything. If you're going to say anything as a national brand, I'm not saying UNLV is a national brand. They're in a major market. You harken back to Jerry Tarkanian and Wild Shit all the time. Like, how do they not make the cut? I can't imagine that they didn't want to be in, and I can't imagine that Oregon State and Washington State were like, no, we'll go with Fresno. Like, I think that there has to be more tranches to this, and that maybe there's politics involved in terms of who exits when, but clearly the Mountain West doesn't have a compelling future, and those teams are going to want to be in. I think separately from that, if you say, okay, it's either going to be TV market, which I know you think is not as important, but if it's national brand, then why are we even having a conversation?
Yeah, it's Memphis maybe is top of that list,
but then you get into their whole we're picky about geography and how much credence do you give that? I actually give that a fair bit of credence. I think you go to the Texas schools. I think that's just barely inside the flying range. And I also think, again, going back to beating my Big 12 drum, you make a play for some basketball only ads. And I'm not just saying that because of Gonzaga, and that's the obvious thing there. If I'm Gonzaga, by the way, this conference is a big upgrade over the WCC, because anything is a big upgrade over the WCC. This isn't 2014 anymore, and we're selling to ESPN and BYU still a part of it. And maybe Santa Clara will be ranked next year. Like, those days for the WCC are largely gone. I would go after Gonzaga, St. Mary's. I would go after Wichita State, and I would go after Creighton. I would try to raid the western flanks of the Big East and raid the western flanks of the AAC, particularly in the AAC. One, because those schools are getting $9 million a year. That's the best G5 TV deal. Can you best that? I think maybe taking those schools that merited that, they can't hurt your case. If you're trying to say we'll get our schools 10 million, and maybe that's way too optimistic, I don't think it can hurt you if you're saying, well, we're taking from the next best, we're taking the cream of the crop from a basketball sense from the next best conference, but not just Wichita State in basketball. I mean, with the AAC, you also get into what the UTSA's, now I'm forgetting if it's UTSA or Texas State. I want to say it's UTSA. Invisible producer Steve will check this.
I think both, right?
Yeah. And there's also North Texas, which is in there now. We're getting into really questionable football quality
too. Yeah.
Yeah. UTEP, but we're getting into more and more questionable football quality, but we're getting into those types of markets. I would also make a play for Grand Canyon. They're loaded with money. They're going to have a football program at some point. It doesn't help you now, but like, there is no national brand. I mean, maybe Gonzaga basketball, but that's not a football school. So in lieu of that, you have to do the best that you can. And I think that is an all hands on deck approach, where you're saying to individual schools, either come to a better geographic footprint for you, or, you know, we're going to be a mini version of the Brett Yormark Big 12, where the NCAA tournament can't happen without us. You wouldn't also have an NCAA tournament without Gonzaga, St. Mary's, and Creighton, and maybe Wichita State. So again, it's, none of this is sexy, but I think it's realistic. I think just saying, well, we want to get a Florida State, just like, get out of here. Like, there's absolutely no way in the world that would happen, right?
Just hearing this, just thinking about this conversation makes me think just how exhausting it probably is to be an administrator right now in college sports, particularly if you're not in one of the big conferences. If you're, even if you're in the Sun Belt and things have been like moderately mild for you so far, like you're just looking at everything else that's happening and understanding that five dominoes away is your school and your future. And I mean, there's just so much, there's so much transient nature happening right now, both on the player side and on the conference side and on the school side and the coaching side and all that. It does feel like, and I think this is why you're seeing a lot of high profile executives in college sports in the past couple of years, hanging it up and retiring or leaving entirely. Cause it's a different game right now and it does not seem to be fun in any capacity.
No, I mean, it's all nonsense. It's people making the best out of nonsense because we destroyed everything.
Yep.
North Dakota State, South Dakota State, Montana State, Montana. It sounds like Sacramento State is going to actually make a play. But those four schools that I mentioned, they've been rumored to be going up to FBS for a long time. Then they've also counter been rumored to, no, they're fine at FCS. They have plenty of revenue there. Also, if TV markets do matter, which is this continual do they, don't they, who the hell cares about Fargo? Like, no offense to Fargo, but, I watch the show and I love the film. So, Do these teams say, all right, let's bide our time. Let's see if this Franken 12 can get the UTSAs of the world, do that little basketball expansion, maybe get a few more Mountain West schools. And then when it actually, is discovered that that's a lot harder than you think it is, maybe they might be more amenable to playing with us. Maybe they might be more amenable to having a combo with us. And if that happens, not only could we get actually more money, but we could actually be theoretically in a conference that has an automatic berth to the FBS playoff, right? That's a pretty big leap. And are those schools interested in it? I want to end on Cal and Stanford. I've heard more reasons for why they will join and more reasons for why they won't join in the past 48 hours, 72 hours than I have of any other school or potential school that's involved here. On one hand, it seems like, yes, it's very hard to leave the ACC. They also just joined the ACC. I've also heard exit fees totaling almost in the nine digits, which seems truly insane from that ACC grant of rights deal. On the other hand,
that's consistent with what Florida State has said.
Right. On the other hand, we know that they didn't want to be in the ACC to begin with. They just made the best of a horrible situation, and it was palatable to them because there's institutions that share their quote unquote self-image of academic rigor. We know that they hate the travel. The travel is truly ludicrous. It's not just like, oh, wow, this is silly. Like flying to Syracuse and Boston and Miami and trying to also play school is insane. We also know that these two schools, particularly Stanford, have more money than Jesus, the largest endowment in the country, and for Stanford by a wide margin, even exit fee in the 50 millions, the 60 millions, the 70 millions, that's couch change from an endowment. So if they really wanted to, and also the ACC is going to go away. So
ACC just going to lose its best teams and then poach what we have here in the Pac-12?
I mean it in the sense that the Mountain West is going away, and that I'm not saying that there will not be something branded Mountain West. I mean, as we know it, it has no functionality. And
yes,
so I don't know who to believe on Cal and Stanford. You could tell me never in a million years, and they're going to pull the cash trigger, and I would believe either one.
I have not done any reporting on this. My sense is that I cannot imagine a world in which Stanford or Cal, but Stanford specifically, dips into its endowment in any real way to pay an exit fee to a conference that they scrambled to join, to go back to the dregs of a conference that they stabbed in the back. I just don't see a world where that happens. The schools like Stanford are fairly loath to dip into their endowment in any capacity, particularly for athletics. And don't forget that Stanford tried to cut like 15 varsity programs like 5 years ago that cost pennies and pennies and pennies compared to what this would cost, and brought most of them back by public outcry. But I would be surprised by that. I agree that the ACC as we know it is going to die either a fast or slow death, depending on what the courts allow Stanford and FSU and Clemson to do. But again, given the news this week, I could just see the ACC retooling with all of the American. Like, I just, the ACC is a brand, and if brand actually matters, because it seems like it did in the Western side here in the past week, they'll just raid some other poor lower conference. They'll take the Sun Belt and the American. But I would be surprised, as much as the travel seems crazy and as much as it was a marriage made of just hyper, just massive convenience in a very short amount of time, I'd be surprised if they go back. But we've seen crazier things. I will say, if they do come back, if I'm the what's now the Pac-6 or whatever, I'm putting them on like a 50-year time horizon to get the full check. I'm making sure that they feel all of the outcast nature of leaving and then coming back. But yeah, that seems, not knowing anything again, that seems unlikely to me.
Imagine scrambling to get the last chopper out of Saigon only to land in a conference that's now going to become the glorified merger of the worst parts of the Sun Belt and the AAC. Like, you went through all of that horrific inconvenience and entry fee pain to now have all of the bad parts, none of the top quality competition.
Yep.
Yikes. You interviewed Adam Silver this past week. And by interviewed, I mean you asked him a question but person to person, right? We're not just talking about a story that somebody else is talking about. This is news that you have made. Tell us about the setting in which you questioned him.
NBA owners met in New York this week for their board of governors. They do this a couple times a year. Afterwards, Adam comes out and speaks to a handful of reporters just about...
Adam, you're on a first name basis.
On a first name basis. Comes out and speaks. Sometimes it's specifically about things that they discussed and big news that came out of meetings. This week was a little bit less of that and more of just kind of a check-in where things are. I asked Adam a sports betting question. We are almost exactly 10 years from him becoming the first commissioner to come out publicly for more legalized sports betting in the U.S. You certainly remember this also, Will. It was a huge deal when it happened. Lot of people kind of credit Adam's public change as being one of the major drivers that started the momentum that eventually led to changes in at the Supreme Court level a few years later. And he is of the commissioners, certainly of the major conference commissioners in public settings, he is by far the most thoughtful. And on topics like sports betting, which demands thoughtful reasoning about what's working and what isn't, and what is a naked cash grab and what isn't, and what is actually a threat to the integrity of your sport and what isn't, he is someone that I always like to hear his thoughts on where things are. And I asked him, looking back after 10 years, kind of what has unfolded the way that he thought it was, what hasn't, and maybe more specifically, how he thinks about the health of the relationship between the sports betting world and the pro sports world at this moment.
He said two things that I want to ask about very quickly. One, he mentioned or referenced that AI is going to help in leading the way on integrity. Statements like this just drive me up the wall, because if you've worked for 5 seconds in integrity, you know that there's like 91 safeguards that do actually work if everyone cares to implement them prior to like 22nd century technology, right? And it's not AI. It's actually making sure the systems are in place to catch things. You just came off of Jonte Porter, and now you're telling us that the answer is AI. The answer is just everybody doing what they say they're going to do. So, yeah. So don't, like, of all the buzzy things to say just because they're buzzy, but they don't mean, like, I really want to know who told him to say that or if he thought of that on his own. That's just more a comment rather than a question. The second thing is that he said he favors a federal framework. I love revisiting this. It was the ultimate hedging of bets, terrible pun. They were, of course, party to the New Jersey case, right? They were the plaintiffs, right? They were the defendants in that case along with all the other leagues, right? The NBA clearly took the position at that point that they didn't want states to be able to authorize it. So saying, well, we were always in favor of a federal framework, one, it allows you to say that you don't really necessarily like what's going on right now and you want it centralized, which they always have. And two, it allows you to say, we were always in favor of sports betting, we just didn't like the mechanism in the PASPA case. It's beautiful. It's brilliant. It's a masterstroke. We now have a federal framework that was released last week. It might have even been on the same day that his comments were made.
It was, I believe. Yeah, it was Wednesday, I think.
That can't have been an accident, right?
Maybe. I mean, this was not, I don't think this is something that Adam planned to say unless someone asked him about it, and I happened to do. It's certainly not an accident or a coincidence in the fact that, like, this is top of mind, I think, for so many people across our industry, your old industry, anyone who works in sports. It certainly feels like we are coming to a head of some sort in the intersection of athletes getting caught and college athletes being prosecuted in weird ways, and then advertising going through the roof again, and now a renewed interest in lawmakers suddenly caring about consumer protections. Like, there's ebbs and flows. It feels like we are in a flow state right now of people trying to figure out what's working, what isn't, and how to fix it.
And this is not the first federal framework bill that's been introduced in Congress. Bills get introduced all the time. This effort is from Blumenthal and Representative Tonko from New York, I believe. One of the many things it addresses is caps on when and how betting advertisements can run. More jarring than that, I think, is the idea that all state laws wouldn't go away, but all state licenses to operate would go away, right? As you know, this happens on a state-by-state basis, and they would have to reapply to the Department of Justice, those noted gaming regulators. It's funny to me that this came out. There are many other provisions in that, by the way. Those are the two that obviously jumped out and caught my eye. I just find it interesting that dropped when the day that Silver made those comments. And do we think that there's any more legs to federal legislation than the zero legs that past efforts have had?
I think the answer is no. I would turn the question on you, given that you wrote about gambling a lot in a past life, worked at the AGA. I think you have a better read on kind of where, certainly legislatively, where things stand right now. But my read is, from everyone anyone's ever told me, this is not anything that's going to happen anytime soon. I am extremely skeptical of the federal government to achieve progress in any realm. Pick your industry or topic. So that's just where I come from. I have not talked to anybody who was really actually in taking seriously the idea of a federal framework. But you tell me if you think I'm wrong there.
No, I don't think you're wrong, but I don't think the leagues will stop calling for it. If this was just a gambit to be two-faced before and right after the PASPA ruling, statements like these would have stopped happening years ago. But the fact that they're still calling for it, I do genuinely believe that they and some others want it. That doesn't mean it's going to happen, but I'm also saying I don't think this issue is going to go away.
I don't think Adam Silver says that to make it sound like they were always in favor of it just federally. But I do think that there's definitely a way of pointing to federal as being, as acknowledging that something isn't working right now without really giving a full accounting of what actually that thing that isn't working is, right? So it's easy to be like, we understand there's some issues here and our solution is federal. Does that fix any of the actual issues? I don't think. I mean, most of the problems that I see and that a lot of other smart people I think see in the very, very convenient marriage of sports betting money and professional sports doesn't have to do with the state-by-state patchwork of it. But I do think it's an easy way to make it clear that you're not fully satisfied with the way things are without getting slightly more serious about what aspects of the way things are aren't you happy with.
Four Michigan football players, including EA 2014 cover boy Denard Robinson, I think that was him, right? Are suing.
It might be, yeah. Jaguars great, Denard Robinson.
Yes. Let's get into Evan's Jags fandom on a different podcast.
Don't you forget it.
They are suing for damages. They are trying to, for their name, image, and likeness being used. They are just four players. They are trying to get classified as part of the existing class action settlements, but it is just a group of these four players. It also, this suit they're filing effectively tries to open the window for athlete earnings even further back from 2016. I believe June or July 2016 was the current date that the House settlement envisions people. That's when everything started being unfair. So from then on, that's when we have to pay people.
That's when college boards was professionalized, that moment.
Right. That moment, that was the point in time. And now they're looking to sort of wind back the clock earlier by virtue of this lawsuit. So one, they clearly want to get paid because they particularly Denard, I'm sure, they're seeking, I believe, $50 million. They think that's what they were owed. This feels, one, a little bit more personal. But two, it feels like just a naked, oh, people are getting paid, but not us. We'd also like to get paid. Now that the floodgates are open, we would also like to get paid. Thank you very much. How far back is this window going to realistically go? Because you could always make the case, ironically, getting more to the principle of the matter, which I agree with, rather than what people are currently saying, which is just the pie is bigger, therefore I want money. You could theoretically trace this back to the 90s, to the 80s, right? I mean, there was still some money being made, right? So if we're talking about the principle of it, money was always made, revenue was always generated off of labor, and it was unfair. Well, who's to say that there isn't another suit that comes and says, no, we need to, you know, move the window back to 2005 or 2000?
Not only can you trace it back, but it already has been. I mean, the GOAT OG of challenging the NCAA in modern legal times is Ed O'Bannon. Yeah, and he left UCLA in 1994 or 1995. I believe, and I don't know for sure, I someone told me once that there were statute of limitations involvements with the 10-year period. Or going back to 2016 and not further back. If I was Denard Robinson and these guys looking to make a case for yourselves, I would be calling Johnny Manziel every 10 seconds, trying to get him to join this lawsuit. Yes, it is very clear to me, as it's clear to you, that athletes have been exploited by a lot of the things the NCAA has been loosening its restrictions on for well before 2016. I'm interested in this. It feels like it is just open season right now to a degree on the NCAA. And the minute this House settlement falls apart, which you and I dove into in depth last week, the minute it actually falls apart and those three antitrust suits go back onto the dockets, I think there's a chance you're going to see a rush of other people with similar antitrust arguments with slightly different flares deciding that they want to jump in as well. I see no end in sight for challenges to the NCAA, either by time limits or degree of exploitation or financial recourse.
One thing I don't understand about it, though, is that they want to just make it its own, not its own, but they want to make it a class action. In other words, they want other people from the year 2013, 2012, yep, 2011, whatever, to be able to join in. They want that track and field athlete, theoretically. They want that swimmer. They want that women's basketball player, whatever, to be able to join in, just like all the other class action suits, right? They could be party, right? But what I don't get about that is that 99.9% of people are not Denard Robinson. 99% of those athletes are not owed $50 million. So on one hand, they're saying, pay me my money. I, Denard, am owed. On the other hand, they're saying, and everybody else, come on. But the further back you go, the less revenues were because of basic math, because of the growth of the sport, because of inflation. But the number of athletes that you theoretically have to divide that by remains the same. Meaning the further back you go, you're fighting for people to get a $300 check instead of a $900 check. Why open it to, why try to become part of the class when clearly this is about, I was on the video game cover, because like ultimately what you're fighting for others to get isn't going to matter.
I would bet that class action status it makes their legal argument stronger. I think you're making good points on just on the financial level, but who knows? Maybe Denard would say that this isn't about the money. Actually, it's about getting athletes who were track stars at Michigan in 2012. And
my friends and I want $50 million, but it's not about the money. It's absolutely not about the money. The walls of the NCAA are crumbling at this exact moment, but it's not about the money.
Touche. But who knows? So I guess the easy answer is I don't actually know. But yeah, I think there are lawyers and there are former college athletes all over who were exploited. Denard Robinson was undervalued and undercompensated as a Michigan athlete. I feel very confident about that. Who are now kind of seeing the cracks in the NCAA and are looking for there. And yeah, I think if I was a star in college football in 2015, and I'm seeing all this stuff come out about going back to June 2016 and billion-dollar settlements and money that's going to be paid out, yeah, I would definitely feel some kind of way about why that line started the day I graduated and not a year before I got on campus or 10 years before I got on campus. I understand that. But I wish I can ask Mike McCann. I can maybe bring an answer at some point in the future.
Bring Mike.
We should bring Mike on. On the pod.
He would love it.
He would know specifically about the 10 years. Is there a statute of limitations? How different this looks? And that could very well be a very easy answer to what Denard is trying to accomplish about how realistic it is or how realistic it isn't.
So let me ask a related but different question. Let's assume that you believe there's a difference at all between current uncapped NIL and naked pay for play. I do not, but let's assume that you think that there is.
Yeah.
How does the settlement containing a mechanism to distinguish between these two things potentially impose an artificial cap on earnings? Because no part of NIL is saying, wink, wink, athletes should have no cap on getting bribed. It's saying there should be no cap on what they can earn from legitimate endorsements, from the use of their image, from labor that they put into stuff. What does distinguishing between those two things, how does that contribute to an artificial cap? Isn't that in everybody's interest?
It's certainly in the NCAA's interest. It's part of the NCAA's, the thing they've always said about the NIL market as it is that they wanted more transparency. They wanted fair market value to be paid. What they didn't want was open market for talent, which I agree with you is largely what we have right now. I think Judge Wilkin in the comments that she made at the hearing earlier this month, what she was concerned about is going backwards there, is that we have a relatively open market now. It is not flawless in any capacity. In fact, it seems to be absolutely insane out there. But if the NCAA wanted to, and I believe the settlement has a clearinghouse where any deal over $600 has to be announced, and then an independent board that decides if Will's $1,000 deal is actually commensurate with his market value for what his deliverables are, or if it's possible that Will's $1,000 is just an inducement for him to go to Wazoo. So we actually have to step in and do something about that and punish Will or punish the school or whatever it is. The NCAA wants a bunch of these kind of enforcement mechanisms in place, transparency and enforcement mechanisms. And yes, I think that she is feeling like the judge is feeling like putting all these things in is going to serve to cool the market, which I agree with. I think if every NIL deal signed in college sports right now had to go through some independent body to decide if this is real NIL or this is fake NIL, yes, the market would shift quite dramatically. We'd probably go back to where we were a month ago or a couple of years ago, right? Which is just paper bags and money and cash and not even NIL. It's just cash.
But not having a mechanism like this in place definitionally leads to paper bags and cash. Like it's cooling the market in the sense that
I think there's less paper bags and cash now.
I guess it depends on your definition of paper bags.
Collectives are
and
just
cash.
Paying kids, right? Like it.
Sure, but like I think part of the problem here is that she doesn't define what pay for play versus true NIL means. And McCann noted that. And in the absence of those definitions, no one comes out and says, I want naked pay for play. Like, no, we don't want that, right? That's all bad. But then when it comes to actually defining what that means and rooting it out, well, we can't do that because that might be unfair.
Yeah, my read on her definition is probably that, like, what she wants to make sure is that athletes are delivering for the people paying them a requisite amount of things to be paid what they're getting paid. Right. And what they don't define as requisite amount is agreeing to play at this school. Right. Like that's the thing that they, and again, I to me, this ship has sailed. It sailed a long time ago. It's been happening very illicitly for decades and decades and will continue to happen in or outside the rules, however a judge or the NCAA wants to lay them out. But that's my read, is that there is a inherent problem with NIL, which is that the like stated case of it is not the way it's being used at all. And I think it's crazy for the NCAA to really think that or try to enforce new mechanisms to try to rein that back in. And I think that that's part of what the judge is saying also, is that like what you are planning to do, while it may add more transparency, is also going to deliberately cool the market for athletes. And that didn't look right to her.
Very quickly, I know you have to go. Please tell me why the FBI is investigating George Washington's trip to the Bahamas. We have to go from very serious business to the gonzo world of the shadow industry of people that put on, you know, paid MTE tournaments for college basketball and team junkets in the off season. Give me all of this. I want all of the info.
This story is so good. And I actually, so I was in, I was on a fishing trip in Canada when this news broke originally, and I didn't have any service. I was out for a week and I totally missed the entire first part of this. So my colleague, Daniel Libet, who got his hands on some FOIA documents that showed the FBI was looking into George Washington for its failed Bahamas trip, when he called me to talk about it, he was like, yeah, you remember that Bahamas trip that fell apart when like an hour before George Washington was supposed to get on the plane? And I was like, what are you talking about?
They were going to do a September off-season trip to go to the Bahamas, play some exhibition games, have some travel. You know, many D1 basketball programs do this.
These like overseas junkets that are partially right. Out like a cool opportunity for kids who many of whom would never have an opportunity to go to the Bahamas to go and do it and under the guise of basketball and some kind of tourism education get to do it. George Washington had agreed to pay, I think it was $160,000 to this group to send, I think it was a group of 30 people, so coaches, right, players, staff, etc. And they had paid an upfront payment of $55,000, and they had a few more due. And it seems like as they got closer and closer to the trip, folks at George Washington, the antennas went up, and they were like, I'm not sure if this thing is real.
Well, the third-party company just didn't make any of their reservations. Flights
have been sketchy. This group has done stuff in or planned to do other stuff in college sports. They do
Hoops Giving, which is one of the biggest college basketball tournaments early in the season, a big ESPN tournament. Is the FBI investigating George Washington, or are they investigating the third party that was
not to my knowledge? No, I think it's the opposite. The documents that Daniel got, and people should read his story at Sportico, they're a little light on the details. He's got some communications of people talking about the FBI reaching out, and obviously the FBI doesn't want to talk about this right now. The FBI has a fairly sordid history of investigating college basketball corruption in the past 4 or 5 years that I know you're very familiar with. Who knows if this becomes something bigger? Who knows if this group is involved in something else? I think it is a funny, sad story on its face, and the federal government caring about a Atlantic 10 basketball team's trip to the Caribbean just feels very funny and out of place to me. But who knows? We may at some point see indictments rolled down federally, and this is a lot more interesting or a lot bigger than we think it is. Who knows?
Who knows? I almost called them the colonials, but hopefully the revolutionaries were not too revolutionary in the tactics that they or their junket provider might have taken.
When's the Robin Sports Invitational happening?
we're still in negotiations. I just need ESPN to give away some of those $10 billion in rights fees.
That who are your dream paying. Four schools? We'll start with St. Francis, Pennsylvania, obviously. Patron saint of the Robin Sports Pod.
Long live the Red Flash, singular.
Singular Flash.
I would say definitely. Other, you mean other than St. Francis, PA?
Other than St. Francis, yeah, they're auto bid. Yeah, they're in the championship game.
I will tweet out the remaining three if I only get four total schools.
Awesome.
All right, man. Thank you for stopping by as always.
Of course, this is fun.
We're contractually obligated to do it again soon.
And we will. Right, don't you fear, you. Guys.
No one, all 12 of you, do not worry.
Do this not is coming fret. Back. We will run it back.